Our third case for argument this morning is Wendler and Ezra against American International Group. Mr. Vogel, you might want to raise the podium. Not the microphone. There's a switch on the right-hand side.
Underneath.
The right-hand side of the podium.
On the inside.
Don't let it hit your chin.
Mr. Vogel.
May it please the court. I'll begin with a hypothetical and then relate it back to the facts of the case. Assume there's a hit-and-run accident. The plaintiff doesn't know who hit him, but he does notice that one of the stoplight cameras is right above the intersection. He goes, he checks out, finds out who is the head running the stoplight camera, asks them, is there any way you can find out for me the license plate of the car that hit me? That person calls him, says, I've checked it out. I've been able to determine this is the license plate of the car that hit you. Depositions are taken, and the license plate is related back to a particular company. The deposition then is taken of the company.
There's a problem. It's as if the affidavit in this case said, I've been able to determine that X is the license plate, but I ain't telling you how, period. Yours sincerely, the affiant. Well, look, the basic problem is that that's not very helpful. You know, it's essentially expert testimony without reasons. It's ipsy dixit. And we say over and over and over that experts have to explain how they reach their conclusion. And this expert didn't explain how he reached his conclusion.
Well, I believe he did for purposes of the affidavit. He said, I used the same software I used to run this website. I ran that program. That program generated this IP address. Now, the defendant has a lot of criticisms of that, but we don't hear these criticisms until their reply brief.
It's like an economic expert saying, I ran SPSS, and SPSS told me X. It's completely useless. You need to know what data you input, what SPSS is doing, what the output are.
It seems to me that the defendant is taking shifting positions on that very issue, whether or not Mr. Ibarra-Laws is an expert or not. If he is an expert, then he is allowed to rely on inadmissible data to form his conclusions.
Certainly he can do that, but he has to explain his reasoning process. That's the basic problem here.
Well, and also that, quite frankly, that issue is not the precise way the district court came at this, nor the appellees. However, if Ibarra-Laws is construed as a lay witness, then his testimony is, I looked, and this is what I saw. And clearly is qualified to tell us what he saw.
But if he's a lay witness and not, say, a lay expert under Rule 701, he does not get the advantage of the rule that he can rely on hearsay to form his opinion.
And that is true.
The only way he can rely on hearsay to form an opinion is if he's an expert. Then he has to explain how he reached his conclusion. That is, he has to lay out his reasoning process. And there's the problem.
Well, and I'll revert to that is not the basis that we were confronted with in the trial court, either by the district court or by the appellees.
But it seems to me you have your choice. You can say he's an expert, and therefore I don't have to worry about the hearsay doctrine. He can rely on inadmissible evidence, but then it's bad because he doesn't lay out his reasoning. Or you can say he's not an expert, and therefore he doesn't have to lay out his reasoning, but he can't rely on inadmissible evidence.
You know, simply, the final point I made as far as the expert issue is, his opinion was, I use the same data I always use to operate my website, and these were my findings.
He didn't tell anybody what it was, right? That's my SPSS example. Almost every expert who's doing a statistical regression or any statistical analysis will use a statistical package. But it won't be enough if you're the plaintiff in an antitrust case to say, I hired an expert, he used SPSS, and he says the market share is X. He's got to explain how he used SPSS to do that.
Well, and I said finally before, my final point on the expert issue is if properly confronted with that expert issue at a time where we could actually furnish a response, then we can generate all kinds of material. For example, if they file a Daubert motion, then we can file a response. We can submit a more detailed affidavit from Mr. Ibarra-Laza explaining his methodology.
Look, a motion under Rule 702, what used to be Daubert, but that's been replaced by the rule, has to do with the qualifications of the expert. The qualifications of the expert aren't being challenged here. It's whether he explained himself.
Well, my understanding is that a Rule 702 motion can also have to do with the expert's methodology. As to the lay opinion, then we have to go to the issue of, is this hearsay at all? And every circuit that has directly confronted the question whether or not it is hearsay at all has said that computer-generated data is not hearsay because there is no person making an assertion. Now, the Seventh Circuit and some other circuits have analyzed computer-generated data under the business records exception, but none of those cases directly confronted the first question, which is this hearsay at all? Are these statements by persons? If it's not hearsay, then there's absolutely no basis for excluding it under the hearsay rule. Beyond the hearsay prop, the hearsay issue in this case, you have two other reasons why summary judgment was improper even before we get to Mr. Ibarra-Laza's first affidavit or a second affidavit. The first one is you have the statement of Arnold Felberbaum, who is their director of IP compliance and security. When he is asked, where did this posting come from? His direct quote is, the information I have is that it did come from my infrastructure.
That's hearsay. You offer the affidavit of somebody who says, somebody told me X. That's the most classic hearsay in the world. You can't get around this hearsay problem by pointing to more hearsay.
No doubt about it, that is hearsay, but it comes with an exception, which is if there's an admission by the party opponent.
It's not an admission that somebody... It is an admission if he says, it is true that. It's not an admission if he just says, somebody told me. Imagine at a deposition, the lawyer says, I say to you, this came from an IP address associated with AIG. And he then says, well, somebody told me that it came from, right? He's referring to the lawyer. He's not admitting that it's true. He's saying that somebody told him.
His direct quote is, the information I have is that it came from my infrastructure. Now, bump a notch. If he said, I was told by an AIG manager that this came from my infrastructure, I think everyone here would agree that that would be an admission of a party opponent. Certainly what Mr. Felberbaum says in his deposition itself isn't hearsay. So the question is, the statement he's saying about what someone else told him, does it come with an exception? The only argument appellees make on this point...
Why didn't you ask him who told him this and then get the deposition of the person who supposedly told him? And then you could find out who it was, whether they were speaking for AIG, whether it was an admission.
That is a hole in the record, and I didn't take that deposition.
Oh.
I would submit that we can make justifiable inferences from the record. He never talked to plaintiff's counsel or Mr. Ibarra-Laza. He is an IP director for AIG. If someone told him something about this case, presumably it would be someone affiliated with AIG. The second issue that is never confronted by the district court is the negligence theory. And negligence theory has two bases. The first is, upon being notified there was information indicating AIG was the source of the posting, AIG should have done at least one of two things. One is thoroughly investigate whether, in fact, it was the source of the posting. Now, they submitted claims and written discovery that they'd interviewed approximately 1,000 claims adjustment personnel. When we depose anyone in this case, and when they even submitted affidavits from this case, all of the live witnesses or the affiant said, I have no information about the posting, including the person who was in charge of the claims department that would have been paying out these claims to plaintiff. The second argument we made is, upon being informed of this, they had a duty to post something on the website to the effect of, we've have this knowledge that this posting came from us without confirming or denying it. We can say that we've checked with our employees, and other employees have any knowledge that's the basis of this posting. That theory is never addressed by the district court in its order granting summary judgment. That theory is independent of whether or not there is admissible evidence tying AIG to the posting in the first place. The only answer appellees have to that is...
I don't even understand the theory.
The theory is that upon being informed that their property had been used to hurt someone else...
That, of course, is the first question in the case. You haven't shown that their property was used to hurt.
Right.
And if you can't show that their property was used to hurt you, there's no obligation to investigate, take steps, nothing. Without winning on your first claim, that is, that this came from their IP address, every other claim in the case collapses, does it not?
I don't believe so. And the way the negligence...
Well, if this posting came from AOL, why would the failure of American International Group to investigate entitle you to any recovery?
The theory on the negligence point is AIG receives information indicating they were the source of the posting, and upon receiving that information...
I must say, that strikes me as a bizarre theory of liability, that this is Madison County land. I mean, you're saying if the posting came from AOL, all I have to do is send a letter to AIG and force them to spend thousands or millions of dollars, and I can recover from them even if I can't show the posting came from them. That's bizarre.
In my mind, it would be similar to if a parent said, your kid's baseball knocked out my window. The parent would minimally have a duty to ask their child, did this happen, did this not happen?
And you think you could recover from the parent even if in the litigation it's shown that the ball came from someplace else altogether?
If it is definitively shown, then no. If the parent goes through the entire time saying, I don't know one way or the other, then yes. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mattson.
Good morning. May it please the court. Eric Mattson on behalf of defendants. Judge Easterbrook, let me first address your question about experts. Mr. Ibarra-Laza was never tendered as an expert. He was never qualified as an expert, and as you pointed out, even if he had been, he provided no explanation whatsoever about the software that he said he used to determine that AIG was somehow associated with this allegedly defamatory internet posting. This is not really a close case. We have this affidavit of Mr. Ibarra-Laza submitted in response to our motion for summary judgment, and it does not pass muster under the federal rules of evidence for at least three reasons. One is the authenticity problem under Rule 901b2, which provides that when you are relying on evidence that comes from a system, you have to provide a foundation that shows that this system is capable and would produce a result that is accurate. That's 901b9. And Mr. Ibarra-Laza's affidavit doesn't even tell us what the software is that he was using to supposedly tie AIG to this allegedly defamatory posting. The next reason for the inadmissibility is the best evidence rule, or the original document rule.
Why do you care about this? Are you worried that Ibarra-Laza might have just looked at the header on an email and you're worried about domain address spoofing or something like that?
Why do I care about the best evidence objection, Your Honor? Is that your question?
The question is this a source of genuine worry, or are you doing this just to be obstreperous?
Raising the best evidence objection?
Yes.
I'm not doing this to be obstreperous.
Right, so
I think
what's the genuine worry?
The genuine worry is that the very purpose of the best evidence rule...
No, I'm not asking about the purpose of the rules of evidence. I'm asking why you think Ibarra-Laza's affidavit is unreliable. Right? You could be just making a pest of yourself by insisting that they spend more money producing better affidavits to prove something that's indisputable. Or you could have some genuine concern about the accuracy of what Ibarra-Laza is saying. The question is, if it's the latter, what is the source of that concern?
The source of that, there is a genuine concern about that, Your Honor. I do have doubts about whether this posting originated from an AIG IP address. And Mr. Felberbaum addressed that in his affidavit. There is the possibility of spoofing. There is the possibility of inaccuracy in this software. And when, from the beginning of the case...
Right. And if domain name spoofing occurs, is the union going to be able to tell?
Actually, just to be clear, this is not a union website. It's a delivery driver in California who set up this website. But whether he would be able to tell if it were spoofed, I don't know. That's where maybe expert testimony would need to come in and explain the reliability of the software that he was relying on in the first place. Moving to the hearsay objection.
If domain name spoofing is invisible to the recipient of the message, then the reliability of the software doesn't matter.
Well, we're talking about two different issues. I agree with your point, but to get to the point, to the question of whether the domain name was spoofed or the IP address was spoofed, you first have to show with a reasonable degree of trustworthiness, as required by Rule 901B9, that the software that we're talking about in the first place is capable of producing an accurate result. If I may, turning to the hearsay problem, we have the same problem here, really, that we talked about with the foundation for authenticity, and that is that this statement that is at issue here, the statement that AIG's IP address was somehow associated with the Internet posting.
Are you going to make a better argument than Judge Easterbrook did?
I don't know if that's possible.
Neither do I. I'm just curious as to why you're crying.
Well, I appreciate your point, Judge Bauer. I will be happy to answer any additional questions that the panel has. Otherwise, I will take my seat.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Blokvogel?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll be very brief. An issue I highlighted in the opening, and I think it's still pertinent based on what we just heard, is that if these objections by the appellees had been raised at trial or in an original motion, we would have had an opportunity to respond to them, at least to the level of specificity we had in the motion to alter or amend judgment. If this court allows summary judgment to persist, effectively what we're doing is we're saying we have a stiffer burden to meet to escape summary judgment than we would to escape a directed verdict. At trial, they could say, you haven't proven there's no original. You haven't authenticated. You haven't given us enough detail on its methods, and we can meet that.
The admissibility of evidence is decided by a judge, not by a jury.
I understand. What I'm stating is, at trial, we would present our evidence. They would make their objections.
No. Look, you present the evidence only if it's admissible.
We introduce the evidence, and then they object to it. And if it does, if the objection is lack of foundation, we have the opportunity to lay more foundation, depending on how the judge rules. I mean, the short story on that is we have much more of an opportunity to respond.
In state court down south in Illinois, but it's not the way they're done in federal court.
As to his points on authenticity, Rule 901 is clear. It states that a matter can be proven by any of the methods. Then it lists illustrations in 901B, and it says these are not the exclusive methods. And I'm not aware of authority that says if you're talking about a process, you are confined to 901B9. As for the best evidence rule, everyone agrees there's no original that exists of what Mr. Ibarra-Laza found. So I don't know why they're even arguing best evidence rule. As to the remaining points in the brief, I believe those points are well covered. The one thing I would like to highlight is we did not need to take a discovery deposition of Mr. Ibarra-Laza. We told the court in a Rule 56F motion that we needed more time to go depose Mr. Ibarra-Laza to confront the summary judgment motion. If we had been allowed to take that deposition, the trial court's own orders suggest that that deposition could have met any of the trial court's concerns. The trial court's finding that the discovery cutoff precluded any deposition after the discovery deadline is not supported by any legal authority. In fact, the legal authorities I cite indicate depositions are often taken for testimony preservation purposes well after discovery. Thank you. That's all I have.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.